Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk with Hans Hassel, who is the author of The Party's Primary, Control of Congressional Nominations. The book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2018, and Hans is with me today. Hans, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the book and your time today. A timely book, given where we are in 2018. Before we get to it, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm currently an assistant professor at Cornell College, which is a small liberal arts college outside of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I will be an assistant professor at Florida State this coming fall. I grew up in Maine, and prior to going to graduate school, I worked on several campaigns in 2004 and 2006, and actually worked for a party organization during that time. And so the book kind of emanates from that experience in some ways, that experience prior to entering academia.
Yeah, super. And congratulations on your news and the book as well. The book is so interesting.
Great to hear.
Your focus here is on the role parties play in primaries. And before we even get to all the work that you've done, I wonder if you could just sort of take us back and talk just a little bit about where primaries come from exactly. It is the context in which the book takes place. They haven't always been the way that candidates get chosen. So how far back do we have to look to find their start?
Primaries began in the early 1900s. They originate actually in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It was the first known place to have primaries. In the late 1800s, they instituted a primary system to nominate candidates for county office. So the county parties instituted that. And the progressives in the late 1800s and the early 1900s really took them as a rallying point to eradicate what they perceived as, you know, party boss influence or interest group influence in the nomination process. They were concerned about representatives being beholden to interests or to party bosses rather than to voters. And so progressives put forward primary elections as a way to take the nomination process out of the hands of party elites and party leaders and turn it over to party voters. There's been some great work by Alan Ware looking at that, and there's some debate as to whether that was actually the reason that they were implemented, but that was always the motivation, that was always the explanation given in terms of why primary elections should be implemented, was that they were going to kind of reduce the role of party leaders and really turn nominations and representation over to voters, and that, you know, representatives would be more concerned with what voters thought rather than what party leaders thought.
Yeah, and your book is very much sort of 100 years later. Where are we in that effort to do exactly that? And your book also fits into this well-known scholarship connected to the Party Decides book and all of the other projects and articles related to it. In thinking about your intent of the book, was your intent to challenge the findings of that work or to build upon those findings? Or something else, really. So, you know, help us connect this to what others have been working on.
Yeah. So the Party Decides views parties as an extended network of individuals. The work that I use is not. I don't think that I think that my work builds upon that. I don't think it challenges what they find, but I think that it tries to apply the role of the party to a much larger set of cases, and to see what's the influence of party right beyond the presidential election. The Party Decides really focuses only on the presidential nomination process, and I think that my view of parties is slightly different than theirs. They view the party as right this kind of informal network that collaborates and communicates, you know, with each other and tries to coordinate on a particular candidate. Now, I think that their view of that is correct, but I view party organizations perhaps as a center, kind of a coordinating mechanism of those larger groups. And so my work looks at the kind of the role of party organizations as coordinators of this larger network in support of a particular candidate. And so I look at how does the party network coordinate, how does the party organization coordinate donors and coordinate staffers and coordinate all the other sort of resources that a campaign needs to have in order to be successful in the primary? And then what is the effect of that support that a party organization may be able to give informally?
So you mentioned earlier that you had dabbled with party organizations in the past. So what do parties actually care most about when backing a candidate at this phase? And what do they do, or what can they do once a preferred candidate is identified?
Yeah, so let's take the second question first. What are parties able to do? What sort of resources can they bring to bear? So for the book, I interviewed a number of party leaders, party elites, major donors, former candidates, campaign staffers, a large number of people. And this is one of the questions that I asked them, right? What sort of resources do parties have that might be able to be useful to a candidate who's seeking the nomination? They mentioned a whole litany of items, but there were three or four that were repeated across party and across region. Things they mentioned are kind of the obvious things like money, right? The party coordinates donors, right? Within that party network, there are a lot of individuals who are interested and willing to give money to a preferred to a candidate, right? Outside that network, it's harder to find. And party staff, within the party network, there are a lot of individuals who know how to run good campaigns, right? Know how to organize volunteers, put together media campaigns, and a variety of other things. And so the party can coordinate, right, sending good staffers to candidates who need that. And there's actually a story in the book about one individual who mentioned a particular candidate. This is a former party staffer, national party staffer. And that candidate came to the national party and said, look, I'm looking for someone who can be my press secretary to run this campaign. And the party really didn't want this guy to win. And so they intentionally sent him the worst possible press secretary to try to derail that campaign. And because they were afraid if that candidate won, they would then lose the general election. And so right, there's an ability to kind of funnel good staff to a particular candidate, or alternatively to try to derail that candidate by discouraging people from working for that candidate, or alternatively sending someone who might be detrimental to the campaign. So it's money, it's campaign staff, it's contacts with media that are useful. And so there are a variety of resources really that are helpful to a candidate to try to get that candidate off the ground.
And what about the first? So given that they've got this set of resources that they have available, they don't give it out to anyone who knocks on the door. What do parties care most about when deciding who's going to get the A-list press secretary and who's going to get the less than A-list, yeah. the D-list press secretary? So how do they determine viability?
Well, so they are looking. They're primarily interested in general election viability, or at least that's what they would always say that they were interested in. I don't think it's entirely just general election viability that they're interested in. There are a variety of other things that drive what kind of motivates them to support a particular candidate. Part of it is about right when you're coordinating large numbers of individuals, right, like you are in an extended party network. Right, coordination is difficult, and it's easiest to do when there's some sort of focal point or some sort of salient individual within the network. And party leaders and others recognize that coordinating behind a particular candidate was easiest when that person was someone salient within the network, someone who had extensive connections to other people in the party, or who held a prominent position, or some other kind of salient individual. So part of it is just right, trying to coordinate. Coordination is difficult, and so you coordinate on an individual who's salient within that network. They also talked in these interviews. People talked about trying to discourage particular candidates from running, not necessarily because that candidate was going to be a bad candidate, but because they needed that candidate to run in another district or another seat. Because without that person running, they might not win that seat. Right? Parties are really interested in right, not just winning one seat, but winning a whole bunch of seats so that they can influence and you know, extract the policies that they want. And so there are stories of Brian Duby in Vermont being discouraged from running for Senate because they wanted him to run for lieutenant governor, or David Minge in Minnesota being discouraged from running for Senate because Dick Gephardt specifically wanted him to run for the House of Representatives because they were afraid that if Representative Minge didn't run for re-election, they were going to lose that seat. And so right there, it's not necessarily just about candidate viability, but it's also about right coordination and spreading out good candidates across races to try to kind of win majorities in order to be able to get the policies that they want.
Now, much of the book deals with the problem of causality between this coordination between parties and candidates.
Yeah,
I wonder if you talk a little bit about why this is a causal difficulty for researchers and how you specifically aim to address this problem.
Yeah, so the alternative hypothesis here is that parties really aren't influencing the process, that they're merely just kind of jumping on the bandwagon of candidates who are going to win the primary election anyway, right? They survey the field, they say, this one's going to win, this is the person that we're going to support. And lo and behold, that individual wins, right? So we see this this correlation between a particular candidate winning and a party supporting that candidate. But in that case, right, it really wouldn't be party support that's causing a candidate to win. They'd just be very good prognosticators, very very good at identifying those individuals who are likely to win. And so that's the problem, right? If we're going to claim that parties are influential, we have to show that it's really not parties jumping on the bandwagon of already viable candidates. This is the difficult thing for research in this area, because obviously a lot of times the candidates that the party is going to support are going to be the best candidates. They're not going to intentionally pick a candidate who they think is going to lose the general election or is going to lose. And that's the difficult part, right? How do you distinguish, right, how much of this is the party identifying a good candidate and thereby just that candidate's going to win anyway, and how much is this the party identifying a candidate and then the party's resources help that candidate get over the top. To try to address this, this is not an easy problem to solve. I look at this from two different directions. One, right, through actual interviews and talking to these people about what the mechanism is, right? How do they coordinate on donors and what do they do? And then trying to support that evidence for that qualitative evidence through some actual quantitative evidence, where I look at the temporal precedent of a measure of candidate viability and a measure of party support, right? So for candidate viability, it would be nice to have polling data for every single congressional election, primary election, right? But that's not possible. So what we can use is fundraising instead. We can look at a quarterly measure of fundraising that a candidate receives, and then to measure party support. Right, this is the other difficult thing. It's right, what parties do is not always front and center on the front pages of the paper. It's often done in kind of a clandestine manner, where it's kind of behind closed doors and talking to each other, these informal conversations, but nothing necessarily on record. In the book, I pioneer a measure of party support that uses a measure of shared donors between a candidate and the national party organization. So in the case of the Senate, that's the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, right? The party Hill organizations. And if we look at the temporal precedent of these two variables of candidate fundraising in the primary and the number of shared donors, the measure of party support, what we see is that whereas party support predicts future fundraising, we don't see candidate fundraising predicting party support. And this is also true if we look just at a subset of candidates who are running against an opponent who had a similar level of previous political experience. So they were experienced political candidates and not no name candidates. And so this, right, this gives us some hint here that, right, the parties aren't necessarily just jumping on a candidate who's the most viable candidate, but rather it's their decision that then increases the ability of the candidate to fundraise and to do well.
Now, does this finding hold for both parties? Are both parties approaching this coordination in a similar way? Can Democrats and Republicans get their candidate in the same fashion, or did you find some differences across the parties?
So they in the interviews they people often referenced their perceptions of differences between the parties, but that was mostly, I mean, it was not necessarily in the ability of the party to do so, but it was mostly in the kind of the process by which parties went about trying to clear the field. Whereas in the Republican Party, they talked a lot more about how it was a little bit more of a hierarchical structure. Whereas in the Democratic Party, some of the interviews suggested that it was a little bit more kind of distributed. But really, on both sides, the party organization is effectively able to try to clear the field for a preferred candidate. This is the interesting thing. So not only are they able to help a particular candidate win, they're also able to discourage candidates from running. That you see that the candidates without party support are about 50% more likely to drop out over the course of the primary election than a candidate that has party support. And so it's not only just about helping a particular candidate win, but it's also about getting particular candidates out of the race. And both parties are really effective at doing that about trying to clear the field for a particular candidate that they want to have receive the nomination.
Now, one of the themes that runs through the book and is particularly important now is whether, and I guess maybe this is the working hypothesis that many people would have, that this basically functions to get moderate candidates within the party to be the candidates, thinking that they would be the most viable in general elections. What if you talk a little bit about that aspect of what you did and whether that push towards moderation, moderate candidates, is really what we see play out, or is something different happening?
Yeah, so Ray LaRaja and Brian Schaffner have a wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago looking at the effect of strengthening party organizations. And there's a number of people who are looking at that. If we strengthen party organizations and the campaign finance rules surrounding parties, do we end up with more moderate candidates? And their theory and the evidence that they provide shows that yes. And the theoretical motivation behind that is that party organizations are less ideological than the Club for Growth or Emily's List or some other kind of ideological organization that is loosely affiliated with the party, but is really involved because they have some sort of policy that they want to demand, the policy that they want out of the process. And so they theorize that the party leaders, the people in party organizations, are much more pragmatic, that they're more interested in winning elections and controlling office, kind of a Downsian view of political parties, rather than being explicitly ideological. They're more of a pragmatist a group of individuals that you find within the party. And what I do in the book is actually look at and test this. So using Adam Bonica's DIME database, we can actually get information on the ideological placement of individuals who are running in the primary. And combining this with this measure of party support, we can look at what's the average ideological position of a party supported candidate compared to a candidate without party support. And I compare this and unsurprisingly, you do see that parties do prefer more moderate candidates. They do have this preference for a candidate who is less ideologically extreme relative to the of the options that are available. The party generally picks the more moderate option, but supports the more moderate option. However, the interesting thing is that this doesn't necessarily appear to be strategic. This really is more of a sincere preference that they are picking moderate candidates. They're preferring moderate candidates in races that are uncompetitive, either races that are completely safe or races that are unwinnable. And so it's in these districts and Senate seats, Senate primaries, that they're preferring a more moderate candidate. And this suggests to me that this is a sincere preference. And so, right, this idea that parties are somehow pragmatic doesn't necessarily seem to line up with the evidence that I find, which suggests, right, really that party organizations are a vehicle that can be captured. And you know, in the past 20 years, you've seen at the state party level a number of instances where party organizations have been taken over by ideological groups. In Minnesota in 1994, I think it was Alan Quist was nominated by the party. It was endorsed by the party organization in their endorsement process over the current incumbent Republican governor. And so, right, in this case, it was a very clear takeover by an ideological group within the party of that party organization. And I think that you may see something very similar here, as people close to Donald Trump, for example, we come into positions of power. You see a shift rightward in the preference of party candidates, ideological location of party candidates after 2012, for instance, right? After 2010, excuse me, in 2012, right? After a bunch of Tea Party Republicans get into office and then start intermingling with party leadership and being on the NRCC and other kind of organizations that are designed to help candidates. So I think that really the evidence suggests that this preference for moderate candidates is not necessarily strategic or as a result of the pragmatism of individuals in these party organizations, but rather kind of the true ideological preferences of the current faction within the party that controls that organization.
Yeah, this very interesting book, The Party's Primary Control of Congressional Nominations, with its very interesting book cover. love the book cover, which
I had a lot of fun with that one.
which anyone listening can go and see and buy a copy of the book and go read the book at the Cambridge University Press website and elsewhere. Hans, thank you so much for your time today.
Heath, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on and chatting with me.